Hi, you're listening to Kayleen Peoples on Talk Agenda. Byron Lars is known for his trademark men's dress shirting and pattern mixing, and his ingenious use of draping and sarong-inspired tying has set him apart in the competitive fashion industry. Not only has he become famous for his menswear line, Green Tea, Byron Mark's Beauty Mark launched in 2001, and his fame has spread throughout the world with not only his fashions, but his Barbie collection too. He has now expanded his reach to his new label called In Earnest. I had a chat with Byron Lars and got the full picture of his career, including the backstory. Some things nobody's ever heard.
So, welcome.
Thank you so much, Kayleen.
You've had quite an impressive career and a long run of it. Tell me a little bit about how you really got started. I kind of read your background, but I'd love to hear it from your words.
Okay, well, I mean, I got started like way back in the 90s, beginning of the 90s. And I was 25 when I decided to start my company because it was, I guess there was a recession around that time. I don't guess there was. And I remember starting because I remember always thinking, because business was so bad at that time, I thought, hey, if I get any orders, they'll be small enough for me to manage them on my own. That was my thinking.
Okay.
Because I was like, okay, I don't want to get out here and then, you know, write a check that I can't cash. So that was really the thinking then, and you know, so it was pretty old school in so many ways, in that like then there were like old school merchants that were around that, like, I really just like sewed some samples in my apartment, put them in a garment bag, slung it over my back, and went door to door peddling my wares, you know what I mean? And people would actually see you, which mm-hmm. is probably the most amazing part. And and they were just, you know, really looking for something interesting. And they were willing back then to kind of support it. You know what I mean? They give you COD mm-hmm. terms, even if they didn't know who you were, if you actually managed to get the goods there on time. And I remember, like, my first order came from Henry Bendel's, which no longer exists, but they were really big on supporting young and up-and-coming talent. And so I remember calling the buyer, telling her what I had. She said, yep, come on up. I did. They gave me my first order. And it didn't even have a top. There wasn't even a top merchandise in with these skirts and all this other stuff, because my last job was, ironically, at a blouse company. I was like, oh, I just don't want to make any more blouses right now. Well, that's going to be a problem since you have a skirt that you need a blouse to merchandise with. But they literally gave me an order on even the sketch of the top for that collection that I did right there in their office. I mean, everything. And they, It was, like I said, it was like COD. So, I mean, you know, they paid me. I had the money. I could, you know, go on and make other stuff. And it was just really great that way. But shortly around that same time, and they gave me the windows, which was like, I couldn't believe. I'm like, really? And they, of course, there was no notification. I was just walking by, and then and there they were. I'm like, oh, my God. But, you know, that was before Instagram and all that stuff. So I saw it. It happened. It was over, and I have no record of it. But it was pretty encouraging.
Well, I think if anything, it was sort of like telling you, hey, this is something you're definitely supposed to be doing because it's coming easily.
Yeah, you know what? It was like that in the beginning, because then I just, you know, again, took that same bag of the same samples around to the magazines. Editors would see you because, I mean, they couldn't look at your Instagram page and decide whether or not they wanted to, actually. Mm-hmm. So it was at Harper's Bazaar that I met a then editor at Jeanette Chang, and she told me about this person who would end up being my first business partner, who turned out to be Marianne Wheaton, and she was the former president of Patrick Kelly, who had very tragically, you know, died shortly before that time, and so her whole transatlantic, you know, past where she was traversing Paris and New York was kind of over, and she was starting this company in New York. She would introduce designers to, like, potential companies that could, like, take them further than they were. So that was, like, really, like, her business model at the time. And, you know, but I didn't know her. I didn't know of her. Jeanette didn't mention Patrick Kelly or anything like that. So I was just like, listen, I guess if I'm going to ever see you again, I've got to go see this person. I was like, is she a store? Because I need more orders. She wasn't. And then I met her, and she was amazing. She was, like, amazingly dynamic character, and whose pedigree was just like, I was blown away. I mean, before Patrick Kelly, she was president of Karl Lagerfeld, and before that, she was, like, a big exec at YSL, and I mean, I was like, oh my gosh, I mean, I did not know. So anyway, she was not looking to be probably in the business that she ended up in with me, because, like I said, she'd moved on from that. She was doing something else now. But anyway, she saw it, and it really spoke to her. And, of course, she had all those lots of contacts and stuff in the industry. So, you know, we scraped together some coins and made another collection. And then, you know, she called up Cal Rutenstein from Bloomingdale's. Cal Rutenstein was the fashion office director. He was back then they had fashion offices where, like, there was just a team of people whose job it was for the stores, department stores, to just go out and find great things and to kind of direct the buys of each department, just so that, like, the direction of the store was in, you know, just had, like, some sort of overarching vision. And so he was that visionary for Bloomingdale's. And he was a really, you know, portly, kind of imposing character. That was his demeanor. And I remember when he came up to the showroom to see the collection, I mean, he was completely poker-faced, like deadpan. And then I'm just sitting there, actually, while watching Marianne show everything. And, you know, he didn't say a word one way or the other. And I'm thinking, well, that's it. He doesn't like it, and I guess that's it. And at the end, he stood up, and he's like, young man, this is the best thing I've blah, blah, blah seen in however many years. And it's like, I want to give you a department at Bloomingdale's. I was like, you can't be serious. I mean, it just can't be. It just can't be this happening this fast. And apparently it was, you know what I mean? Because, I mean, that's just, it was. And certainly, you know, to have an inroad of somebody that could actually call Cal Rutenstein and actually get him to come to the showroom and see your collection obviously helped a great deal. So, I mean, you know, there's no way, even though people would see you out of nowhere, I don't believe I would have gotten in to see Cal Rutenstein if I called Cole with that same garment bag on my back. I just don't see it happening that way. But in any case, so that's how all that started happening. And, you know, we didn't even have the money to finance that at the time. So we were looking for financing. And at the same time, I was just, you know, just having faith that the bridge would be finished by the time we reached that big chasm. And it did come in the form of a Japanese backer at, you know, the time who save the day. So we, you know, we shipped and we did shows after that. And I know I'm kind of like skipping through it, but then the Japanese economy fell in, you know, just imploded, and my Japanese backer backed out, and, you know, everything just kind of imploded on itself. And so I had to pick myself up and continue on by some means or another, and found this Romanian shirt manufacturer that you know, made men's shirts. But then, of course, you know, one of the hallmarks of my start was making riffs off of a white button-down shirt or striped Oxford shirts and all that. They were, like, twisty, turny, tied, and draped in the super feminine shapes and all that stuff. That's really kind of what put me on the map at that time. And this manufacturer made shirts, so it was kind of, you'd think, very good match, but not so much, as it turned out, you know. Working in Romania was dicey at best and dubious at worst. I mean, extremely.
So there's some dangerous stories there, perhaps?
Well, not really dangerous, but just certainly not above board. You know what I mean? It was really sketchy. And as far as the elephant in the room, like, so being black in the fashion industry and all that stuff, of course then, back then it was just not something you talked about if you wanted a future. You don't talk about the discrepancies between white and black designers. But of course, as far as my intro into this, I mean, I couldn't see any because it was just happening pretty effortlessly. I mean, for lack of better words, there's tons of effort. I mean, it's even with it being easy, it's a very hard industry because it's just the nature of the beast.
Yeah.
And, you know, because before we had financing, I left this part out. Like, you know, Marianne was, you know, and they'd written about us in Women's Wear and given us a cover, and they called me the Rookie of the Year and all this kind of stuff. But still, we had no money, you know. And all this was going on, and then the stores were calling Marianne, like, hey, you know, we want to carry the collection. And she's like, well, if you want to carry the collection, you're going to have to give 50% of your order up front to help finance making it, because otherwise we can't get it to you. And they did back then. Can you believe it? Not knowing how it worked, I didn't know how extraordinary that was, even though everybody was telling me. I think the nature of the human condition is that you feel like if it's happening to you, then it's happening to everybody, or it can happen to anybody because, you know, I'm just me.
Yeah. Well, there's a lot of truth in that, too, because it just seems, well, if I'm getting it, everyone else must be getting it, you know.
Well, then, too, when I had that cover of Women's Wear and then scraping up the then dollar to buy the paper, then the jig was up. I'm like, now I'm not believing anything in this paper, because I'm like, I am about as destitute gets, and I'm on the cover of the industry paper, and what does that mean? You know what I mean? I'm like, this is really dramatic, the contrast.
If I may, that's the issue. It's like turning publicity into profit. It's always the challenge.
Yes. It really is. Although, we were actually profitable our first year, which is really kind of miraculous. I'm like, oh, you mean we actually made money?
Actually unheard of.
You mean I'm going to get paid? I'm going to get a check? Get out. And then, you know, of course, like, you know, in the midst of a recession, which is why all these new upstarts, like I was then, lots of us were getting a chance. So there was like this whole category then called young designer. And lots of new people with small businesses starting out were really getting big opportunities because the worse business got out there on the whole, the safer and the more bland the real established brands were becoming because they couldn't afford to risk, you know, not selling. But, of course, that what that does is just make everything completely bland and a backdrop for any small exciting thing that comes along that looks like the next best thing by comparison. And I guess that's what was happening. I was like a part of that whole dynamic happening, which was very good timing. But anyway, before the Japanese backers backed off and everything was blowing up and you know, we were having shows and getting all these great reviews and stuff, you know, it was really probably the most depressing time in my life. I was, like, probably at the lowest point that I can recall at the highest point of that moment, because I was so green in this that my business outgrew my experience or my capacity to keep up with it overnight, literally overnight. You know, the older you get, you realize, like, okay, everybody's insecure, but there's nothing to bring out your insecurities more than that whole dynamic. Everybody's looking at you and waiting for greatness, and you're just like, look, I'm just trying to keep up here because this whole thing is just bigger than me. And, I mean, even though I started, it feels like Frankenstein dynamic, like, okay, I created life, and then it turned on me. Stalking me. You know? And so that was really...
I have something to say to that when you're done. I have something to say to that, but go on.
You know what? That's pretty much it.
Well, you know, when I started doing Agenda, and that was back in 2004 when we did our first issue of Agenda, and I started to interview several designers. The magazine was mostly a designer magazine, fashion designer. We were known for interviewing fashion designers. Mm-hmm. I had no scope of how daunting it was to be a successful designer until I started interviewing these designers and discovering you had to reinvent yourself every 6 months, come up with a collection. And I was blown away by, first of all, you're living your job. It's your life.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
It's not glamorous on the inside at all.
No.
And you were coming up in a time when it was becoming, the new celebrity was the designer. Designers are becoming celebrities. Because, you know, think about it, Fashion Week, and you're getting, like, all of the media all around the world. It's up, everybody from around the world, top photographers, top videographers, news people, writers, are right there on that riser, are sitting in the front or second rows, just looking at you. You were the spotlight. And it was like one show could launch you. And from there, if you don't have your if you don't have your plan ready when that happens, it could be a colossal fail. A career.
And you never have your plan ready. There's no way you could have your plan ready, because who's ready for that kind of, you know what I mean? Because it's not natural. It's supposed to happen incrementally. And you're supposed to learn incrementally, but that's just not how life is sometimes, you know? And,
well,
you know.
It's true. I mean, it is very true what you're saying. And particularly with designers, I have major props for designers. Major respect. Because that is serious work.
You know, I always thought it's not, I mean, it's a lot of work. It's not rocket science or anything, but it's like, I just was really surprised at the time at how much people were, like, the celebrity factor of it, because it's just like, listen, I'm just a struggling guy making clothes and doing this, because, like, at the end of all those big moments, like you said, with the world press and everybody clicking, then the next day, there wasn't even laundry in my apartment building. I'm at the laundromat. Chelsea doing my clothes, you know what I mean? And it's like, okay, you know, that was all the glamour that there was at the end. It was very surreal, you know what I mean? It's just like, wow, okay. But it puts it in perspective, like, where makes you put it in its place.
Mm-hmm.
It's like you see, it's not really real. It is in its own respect, but it doesn't really define your reality. I remember it was like Fashion Week. I don't even remember what collection, but it was like coming up on 3 o'clock in the morning. And I was coming from the factory and I was on a freight elevator, and Mr. Calvin Klein himself is on it with me, who is apparently in a much loftier but similar position. And I was like 26 by then. And I remember thinking, because of all the hoopla, he knew who I was, and he spoke to me, which was surreal enough. And he asked how I was coming. I was just like, and he's like, "You working late?" And I'm like, "Yeah, I am." I'm like, "But what are you doing here?" I'm like, "You should be on thousand count Egyptian cotton sheets, dreaming of sugar plum fairies, not here in this hellhole. On a freight elevator at 3 o'clock in the morning. I was like, that was my first glimpse into the future. Like, I'm like, wow, he's really there at the pinnacle, and he is here on this freaking freight elevator with me at 3 o'clock in the morning. I'm like, this is what it is. This is not like some temporary hard times to get it going, and then eventually you're just not working as hard. This is just what it is. And at that time, I can't even tell you how that freaked me out. Of course, now he came down and there was a car waiting for him, and I had to hail a cab. Black man in New York at 3 a.m, good luck. You know, sometimes it works, sometimes it doesn't. But at the same time, I was just like, wow, still, he is there, and he is still here at 3 a.m, because it's Fashion Week is coming up. I'm like, wow, that's rough. That's rough.
So that for you was like a defining moment then, wasn't it?
This doesn't go away. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. I guess if you care. I guess there's different types of people, but I guess if you don't care on that level, I don't know how well you're doing, because nobody else could care that much, I guess. You know?
Well,
there it is.
I would think to be, if you're going to be a designer, it's got to be a passion. It's got to be something that's in your blood. Like, you just can't get it out anyway. You have to do it.
Absolutely true. You don't pick it. It picks you.
So moving on into this interview, you've done some pretty amazing things. I mean, the Barbie thing. I mean, tell me about that.
Well, the Barbie thing started with Mattel reaching out, you know, like in the mid-90s or something like that, mid to late 90s. And again, like I said, he didn't talk about black then, or blackness, mm-hmm. or the notion of, we contacted you because you're black and we want you to do black dolls. So that was like one of these unspoken things. But of course, I'm black and you're contacting me to do Barbie. Of course she's going to be black. I mean, of course she is. But in any case, you know, that was just something that was just kind of not spoken. It was so weird, you know what I mean? Mm-hmm. Like, it's like the elephant in the room. I'm like, let's celebrate that elephant. I love the elephant. He's amazing. And he's going to be black. You know, it's like, what's the big deal? But in any case, there was just a lot of... I guess there was a lot of old guard back then at Mattel that, like, had some very, like, staid notions of Barbie and who she was and what she did and how far she could go. And it just was really kind of it was pretty darn stagnating in the beginning because, you know, that's just how it was. It was, like, all kind of, like, committee, you know. And it was so frustrating because their design staff and, like, the person in charge of my dolls, like, you know, that would, like, get it all into order and get all the designers on it, like the hair and the sculptors and this and that, and was this person, Ann Driscoll, who's so amazingly talented. And so many of their designers there were so talented. They were so eager to do something else. And then, you know, of course, it gets to committee, and then it was Anne's unfortunate task to, you know, kind of communicate all these misgivings to me that, you know, Barbie can't be in pants. This was once. I'm not even kidding you. Collectible Barbie, she needs to be in a gown because she's glamorous. I'm like, in pants can't be glamorous? It was like kind of that. So, you know, after the first doll that we got through, which was fine, it just sold really well because I think primarily because, I mean, she was a good-looking doll and everything, but let's face it, I mean, she was black, and I was black. I guess black women were just dying for this to happen. Do you know what I mean?
Mm-hmm.
And an opportunity to be represented, you know, yeah. in that way, 12 inches tall and fabulous.
Yeah, I was going to say, your black Barbie was... Barbies were the bomb. I was going to say that.
Aw, well, I really
I'm a Barbie
that,
collector.
You,
I collect Barbie. So
you do? Okay, you're one of them.
I'm
and there's
one
so
of them.
Many of you. You are
yeah.
There are so many of you, and, like, you are so varied. I really had an education
mm-hmm.
in designing for Barbie in, like, how diverse and inclusive that group is long before those were buzzwords. It was
yeah.
like, wow. Okay. I even found it, like, Jason Wu. He said,
yeah.
I got all your Barbies. I'm like, you're kidding me. I'm
yeah.
like, what? So, yeah, they come in all packages. And but what was really most important to me and what resonated the most with me, like, you know, after we got through the first, it was supposed to be one doll deal, by the way. And then she sold so well that, like, you know, of course, it led to others. And then by doll number four or so, that was when, like, some of the old guard started to retire and new people were coming in management. And they were like, listen, as long as you're hitting the numbers, I mean, we're not going to be, you know, stagnating the vision. And, you know, you guys do what you want to do. And that's when they started, because I was dying to get some kinky hair on her. You know what I mean? I'm like, come on. Just the idea. You know what I mean? Like, and I was dying to do an Alec Weck dark one. And it wasn't allowed until some retirements and all that stuff happened. And finally, when it did, you know, it sold really great because, of course, she's amazing. Look how gorgeous that color is. Look at her. But, you know, there were just some ideas before that just were not in alignment with that kind of forward thinking and all that stuff. And then, you know, I started meeting black women, particularly out there in the world, who collected them. And I realized, you know, that some of them would be, like, close to tears about, you know, this doll that, like, she identified with, like, that's me there. And I'm like, whoa, this is so much bigger than just, you know, this tiny, fierce doll, because that's all I was just operating from there. Whereas I'm like, look, yeah, let's make boots for her. You know what I mean? I was on a very, very, very shallow level with Barbie. Look, yeah, I wanted her to be dark, Alec Weck, but I was really not on some sort of soapbox about inclusion, and I just thought it was, like, really neat because, you know, I've seen a million women that was so fierce in this color, like when they wear white against that skin. It's so awesome. But I was not really, like, trying to be all militant or anything. But then when I was like, oh, my gosh, you mean this is really meaningful to people? And then when I thought about it, I'm like, of course it is. You know what I mean? When I really met them, I'm like, yeah, of course it is. It's like all those white dolls all those years and the ones that they just copied on a black doll and none of the colors or sensibilities had anything to do with us. You know what I mean? It was.
Oh, it's true. It's just a Barbie with a dark brown, a chocolate face, but it's really a white doll.
Yeah. And you're like,
yeah.
Like, because nobody cared. Nobody thought about her enough, and nobody, you know what I mean? And so, you know, when I really, really, you know, was faced with it, I'm like, I guess it's pretty obvious that this would be something to people. And then, like, there was one, you know, because took a while for me to do a light complected one because it was just natural for me to just do them chocolatey because you just did not see beautiful chocolatey dolls. But then I remember the first really light complected one I did was like fire too, because it's like, I'm sure light girls were like, well, what about us?
I know. That's the problem. I got to tell you, that's when I used to model, I would get, oh, I'm sorry, and when I did get work, they would paint my skin a 5 or 6 shades darker just so that I could represent. I got literally kicked out of Ebony Fashion Fair because I was too thin for the clothing, because the average girl was typically a size 9 and I was a 4. I couldn't fit the designers were complaining. I was one of the best runway models, and they had to pin the clothes on me, and I finally just got fired because I was too thin. Well, wait a minute. I'm one of the blacks too. I
mm-hmm.
just happen to be a shade lighter, and my body's a little different, but I'm still
yep.
in that category. You
exactly.
Know? And we've
it's just
gotten,
like,
yeah, we've gotten left out a lot because we're not black enough, you know.
See, and that's just not right.
Yeah.
Like, we can't be doing that to each other. There's just no way.
And
I mean, that's just not right.
And it happened.
And it's just not right. That's why I remember, like, by the time I got into the light doll, her name was Sugar.
Uh-huh.
And, you know, she had this big red afro. But there was, like, this huge straw hat, like, kind of, like, perched on it. It almost looked like the lid of a pot to kind of, like, contain it all. And I'm like, oh, she's light, but she is, oh, no, she's a sister.
Yeah.
You know, big lips, the whole nine yards and whatever. And I knew, I'm like, by the time we got there, I'm like, oh, my gosh, don't let me be that guy and do that. I'm like, no, she has got to represent all of us. Because, you know, by then I was really getting what it meant, you know, all that kind of, all those shades and all those hair textures and all that stuff, you know. And it was so fun, too. And, like, when you see them all lined up together, it's pretty.
This is interesting hearing the background of the Barbie stuff. This is like, I can't find that online.
Yeah, because, you know, and thankfully, like I said, so many of those people from back then retired, so it's really not, like, scandalous and, you know, irreverent. Like, oh, I can't believe you scoffing at, like, the opportunity we gave you. Because I wasn't, you know what I mean? It was just like, but it was just so puzzling to me because I'm like, well, you brought somebody from the outside to give, like, something else, bring something else to this. And, you know, so, of course, once they allowed that to just express itself, it was amazing. And, of course, their designers there, they had so much talent there. They were on fire making those things real. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah.
It takes so much work for so many people to make those dolls what they are. And they were just, they were so eager to, you know, make it so, like, to make something that cool and, you know, authentic. Like, it was really a special experience. And I'm so thankful to have had it.
I'm actually looking at that Barbie, by the way, the one you just described. Yeah, she's wearing a straw
hat. Is that you? Is that you?
It's a lot me, yeah. You know, because I was born with red hair.
Really?
I'm a blonde now, but I was born with red hair.
Okay, so see, I didn't even know.
In fact, we even have the same. This is me. This is a lot of me, yes. This is a lot of me.
Well, you know what happened, though, like, what's so funny is that, like, by the time I struggled through the first doll or whatever, you know, like, just trying to get in alignment with their sensibilities and what I could sign up on or whatever, I realized that this doll was my cousin. It was, like, my cousin and, you know, there's my cousin, guy cousin, his name is Paris. His mom's name was Ever J. Her father's name was Jay. And she was Ever Jay, which I thought was pretty poetic. But anyway, she was like really chocolate fire and really glamorous. She sewed her own clothes. She looked like really cool. And I did not even realize until this doll was done that it, oh my God, I have made Ever Jay.
You
know, once it was done, I'm like, I have got to get this to Ever Jay because, oh my gosh, it is like I have made her. I didn't even know.
Yeah, this is, I got to tell you, I don't know, I might have to get this doll.
You know what, though, now they're, I don't know, it's because, of course, Mattel doesn't have any. They're all traded between collectors that, you know,
it's Korean,
mark them up. And
the one I want is unavailable.
Yeah, they're like, they're all gone now. It's like collectors sometimes trade them at super inflated marked up prices and all that stuff, but
oh, I'd pay.
Yeah.
I was looking for an Audrey Hepburn doll. I was willing to pay $600 for that doll if I could have just found it.
Yeah, wasn't it great?
I was willing to pay. My husband goes, what would you like for birthday? I want this last Barbie collector with Audrey Hepburn because I collect Audrey Hepburn dolls. I got to have this one. And we looked for like 2 months, couldn't find the doll. And I was like, I give up. I want that doll and it doesn't exist anymore, you know.
Yeah, you know what? I mean, collectors are, I see. You guys are serious.
Oh, yeah. Oh, no, I'm great. I mean, I collected all the Audrey Hepburn dolls available. Now I'm on to Grace Kelly's. And, yeah.
Oh, great.
And I'm
going
to have to get yours now, those that are available. I'm going to have to, add you to my collection.
Okay.
You know, I got to tell you, I don't know if you remember, I don't know if you know this, I think it's Joseph Decker. Anyway, he's a dancer, had a dance group. And I went to interview him at his estate in Beverly Hills. Well, it was on Sunset, kind of on the border of Beverly Hills, that area.
Uh-huh.
And I walked into his house, and the whole house was filled with Barbie collectibles, starting from the 1950s on up.
Whoa.
And I was intrigued. I couldn't even focus. I was so like, oh my gosh, Barbie everywhere. Like, it's a big deal. People really go, I'm one of those crazy people. I will search high and low for a doll.
Hey, you know what? I came to get it. Once I was a part of it, I came to get it. I was in, like, Paris once at a Premiere Vision at a fabric show, and these two Italian guys are like, Byron Lars. And I'm like, yeah. And I'm just like, wow, I'm thinking that they're, like, fabric suppliers. Because, you know, they're Italian, I'm here. They're calling my name. I mean, they must be one of the suppliers we buy from. But I was trying to place their faces like, oh, my gosh, can you sign this? We have all of your Barbie. I'm like, whoa. I'm like, get out. Okay, I didn't see that coming.
I'm going to tell you how crazy we are. I'm literally, like, I was going to build a room just to put my collectibles in it.
Okay, I believe it.
I've
heard of those rooms. Many collectors have, like, you know, fessed up to those rooms, and my dolls have an area, and doll A, B, and C has an area, and nobody can come in there without their permission.
Yes.
Nobody
can
touch anything.
No air has ever touched the doll.
Yes, exactly. Yeah. I'm like, okay, y'all are serious.
Yep, we are. I even wanted a doll. Like, I was going to call myself the flutician. I was doing an interview once, and I'm a flutist. And the guy goes, "Oh man, I heard your music, man. You're like a flutician." I said, "Oh my god, that name is sticking. I need a doll called the flutician. I should be flying on my flute. You know, both feet like sort of like a saucer, and
yes.
Just some fierce person on her flute being the flutician, catering to all the little 8 and 12 year old girls that want to play flute."
Yeah, you know what? That is a good one because, you know, it's so off. Like, I'm sure they probably explore that now because I remember they had, like, when I was doing the collectibles, they had a retail doll, like, you know, at real people prices that had, she had a few statements that she said, and one of them was, get this. And oh boy, they had to pull every one of them. She said, one of her phrases was, math is hard. Can you believe it? I was like, okay, I'm so insulted. I'm seeing red and I'm even seeing
yeah.
Like, I'm like, I can't even imagine. So, of course, they had to, like, pull that. I'm like, really? You're going to put that in little girls' heads?
I know, that's
really?
Funny.
That's what you want to do with this
yeah.
platform. So now,
even
of course, she's been everything. Well, math is hard unless you're like one of those people that like loves math and math loves you back, but you should certainly not, you know, proceed with a notion that there's something that, like, you know, is going to be beyond your grasp. I was like, the whole point of that doll in terms of is like to teach girls to dream big and go for it because you can be anything. Barbie can, and she says you can too. Go for it.
Okay.
Not math's hard.
Yeah, let me ask you a question then on Barbie. Then we're going to move on to another question. On Barbie, what do you think about Chubby Barbie?
I love Chubby Barbie. And, in fact, Chubby Barbie came down the pike when I was working on Barbie, and I loved her so much, and she got shot down so fast in the market. People were just not ready.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, that happened, like, I think it was in the early 2000s, the first time they tried to launch her. And
but they did do a second launch.
Exactly. And which I guess was marginally successful. But I guess just the idea of Barbie is so pretty specific in terms of her proportion, which, hey, good or bad, love it or hate it, I guess it is what it is. It's like, and changing it, it's like new Coke or something, you know.
Yeah, exactly. Well, I mean, that's the thing. Okay, this is my philosophy, okay, and gosh, I hope I don't get striked down for this statement. I am in the fashion industry, and I used to be a model. Okay, so models, in my opinion, should be the epitome of the vision to help women make a choice of clothing or whatever, and that's why they are real thin, or that's why they look the way, because clothes need to hang on them a certain way. When you have too many, too much junk in your trunk, it sort of detracts from the actual outfit, you know? And Barbie,
I hear what you're saying there.
Yeah, and Barbie is more like the idealistic way of seeing ourselves, even though that's not how we really are. But why does it have to, why does everything have to be realistic? Why can't it be idealistic? You know, and that's what I see Barbie as, more like the idealistic version, which is completely unrealistic. I mean, come on, nobody's waist is that small with boobs
well,
that big.
Yes.
It's not possible without some kind
no.
of modification to the body. Certainly not a good
yeah.
body image, but it's really not about that. It's more about
no.
the idealistic version of her, you know.
Well, I agree with that to a very large extent because, I mean, would Calvin Klein have ever sold a box of underwear if there wasn't a perfect body
no.
in those underwear?
No. Oh, come
like,
on. If he was a man with a six, with a, instead of a six pack, you
a
know,
keg.
Had a hanging gut over a pair of briefs, do you honestly think anyone would buy those briefs?
Not so much.
Not so much. And the same thing with even, and this is not a bad thing, and I don't really mean it in a bad way because, you know, we do need to start embracing all body types, and we have. This world is starting to do that. However, it would be hard-pressed for me to purchase a gown or a dress on a woman who has, you know, like folds of skin, and she's wearing that. I can't even see me in it.
Yeah, well,
you know?
But that's like conversely, though, how they feel on the model standard, like they can't see themselves in it. So I really do love this idea of inclusion because, hey, we are all beautiful no matter what size we are. And I am all the way down for Plus Girl and all the way down for celebrating her in that kind of editorial way. But you're right. This is why inclusion is so important because mm-hmm. you couldn't even see yourself in that on her, like, and imagine a version of it for you, well, just think, that's her reality every day and
exactly.
all her life.
No,
and,
no, and I get it. I get that. And they do have, you know, runways for plus size, which I'm glad
yeah.
they're doing now. And they're starting to incorporate plus size in collection of regular size
is
models, too.
The absolute evolved way to, like,
yeah.
think about it and approach it. Now, of course, it's got all kinds of logistical problems and stuff because I mean I tried that before and you know I'm still so all about it in terms of like the idea but in terms of the business model it's really a struggle to make it you know
mm-hmm.
happen that way and to be egalitarian in price and all that stuff when there's some realities I'm using more fabric for this and less fabric for that and all
mm-hmm.
that stuff but you know what I mean to try and like just equalize it but a perfect world would be where, you know, things that are, of course, that work on different body types
mm-hmm.
would go from, you know, small to very large. Very small to very large.
Yeah.
But here's the thing, though. When you do that, you've got to rebuild everything. Like, when we approached Plus, I mean, we would build the same dress twice. We'd build it on a size
mm-hmm.
2. And grade down to 0 up to 12, and we build it again on a size 18 and grade it down to 14 and up to 22. That was really the only way to really get all the proportion
mm-hmm.
and just to get the fit right for her. Yeah. It's not just bigger. There's all sorts of other considerations and changes that happen in there to make it really right on her, you know? Mm-hmm. And when it is right on her, because, you know, you so oftentimes see it not so right on her, but when it is right on her, she looks amazing.
Yeah.
I mean, on a, like, next level amazing, because she is.
I agree.
She just found something that actually shows that, you know?
Yeah.
And, but back to the whole, like, premise of this, like, yes, you still, though, I see that body on the Calvin Klein box. That's kind of in my imagination when I put on the Calvin Klein underwear. I don't need the mirror to tell me that it's not true. That's what's in my head.
I mean, again, you know, you think about the world of view of what's considered beautiful anyway, but then you go to some places. There's a country in Africa, I can't remember the name of it, where the women are, the bigger they are, the more beautiful they are. Like, big is beautiful in this particular country, in this region.
But that's the reverse of what we've got, because they make them sit on a couch and drink milk. Like, I remember seeing a story on that on PBS, and there was this athlete, and she ran, and she loved, you know, exercise and this, but it was time for her to get married, so she had to get fat.
Yeah.
So they made her literally, it was like she was on bed rest, drinking, like, gallons of milk a day.
But I guess,
and it was,
it was horrible, but
horrible.
I saw the same documentary, but the point I'm making is, it's all in the eye of the society, like, what is beautiful, you know.
Exactly.
So, yeah.
But I think, look, when we really get this right, and we're getting there, beautiful is what you are naturally and authentically.
Yeah.
And if that's thin, if that's rail thin or curvy and voluptuous, it is all good, because God made you that way.
Exactly.
And you don't make no mistakes. You're good.
All right. Okay, so you know what? We're approaching an hour here, so I'm going to ask you a couple of questions that I always ask every interview. You kind of told me a little bit about some of the hurdles being a designer earlier in this conversation. Is there anything else particularly that you wanted to say might be a hurdle as a designer?
You know, I think now, probably, I just love that the fact that everybody's gotten super honest about, you know, the inequities of Black people in this industry as compared to others. Because it's something, like I said, you just weren't allowed to talk about that in the 90s. And even though my start may have been probably antithesis of that, like, 'cause I'm like, hey, this is happening for me, I'm Black, and what next? But then I couldn't get arrested at Vogue magazine. You know what I mean? It's just like, even though all this other stuff was happening, there were definitely some doors that were absolutely closed and locked shut to me. It became apparent, because it was, and I'm not saying that because, look, my stuff is great, I should be in there. No, it was only natural because, you know, if you're in the industry and you're being covered by the trade papers, you are selling to top stores and with your white counterpart, it only stands to reason that, like, even from the law of averages, then you would be covered from time to time or have a pull from time to time, make it to print. The fact that that never happened in certain, and it wasn't every magazine, because, of course, Elle has always been about inclusion when that was not even in vogue at all. But, you know, it just becomes kind of obvious, like, hey, that is what's happening here. What's great about young designers now is the fact that that is all out on the table, and there is a mandate to include all types of people with things to offer, which is the only way the industry at large, or any industry, is going to get to the best of the best, is to really cherry pick the best of the best. And that come in all packages, you know, and that's what I think is great. But I think the struggle now is there's just, it's probably harder to even though it's easier in terms of social media and being able to get your message out there independently, there's also so much more out there that it's probably more challenging to distinguish yourself among the crowd with so very much out there. It's like, unless you almost have to become an ad exec.
No, it's true. It's gotten with all the noise, and I agree, with all the social media noise on top of it, it's, yeah, you're just basically lost in the sea of it, you know. It has become a level playing field, though.
But
getting caught.
Yeah. When you have the soul of an artist, you want to just create stuff. And unfortunately, you've got to be an artist. And, of course, in fashion, your art is your business. Everything is business. So I'm not trying to divorce that part of it. But then it's just like artist, like talent, you know, ad exec. It's,
I know.
Because this is what everybody is now, art director.
I know.
So that aspect is really super challenging, and I think probably a bit unrealistic to expect that everybody can be all those things while also giving the attention that is warranted to their actual love and the discipline in which, you know, their vocation calls them. That's the part that is very, very challenging because, I mean, hey, we're all in that reality now.
Yeah.
Particularly trapped inside.
Yeah. And it's become the barometer of success now. And it's like you have to make a choice. And it's like you just made a very good statement, really good point. How can you deliver stellar product at such a high level and have to focus on how many Instagram followers you have? How are you supposed to do both? And the people who market Instagram now are charging corporate prices. So it's not like some people can't even afford to do the corporate rate to keep their Instagram pages filled with, and then Instagram has their own algorithms anyway. So it's like they're removing people out of your thing if they're not active, and then all that work you did to build up your numbers, or half of them are gone, you know.
Mm-hmm.
And so it's just like, oh.
We're back to the same old system before any of this existed.
Yeah.
It's just electronic.
Yeah. Yeah.
So.
Yeah.
With all that, like, claim about egalitarianism was, I guess, a bit of malarkey in the end, as it's going forward.
That's a really good point. Let me ask you, how has the pandemic affected your business, or has it?
It's devastated it, you know, on the one hand, but it's also afforded me another opportunity to, you know, end an old partnership that wasn't working and establish a new one that I'm very, very enthused about and start a new label. In the midst of this, I guess a lot of things are starting from this as the result of necessity or just opportunity in the midst of it all. So here I am. It's like coming full circle. Remember I told you I started in the recession all those years ago? Here I am starting something new in a pandemic. So history repeats itself for sure, right?
Yeah. Tell me about your new label.
The new label is In Earnest.
Okay.
Earnest is my middle name, Byron Earnest Lars, and it was also the name of my dearly departed father, who was indeed an earnest man and did face all life's challenges in earnest. So it was firing on so many levels, that name, that and we do indeed plan to do everything in earnest in this endeavor. So that is the name of the brand, and, you know, I'm still very much obsessed with the experience of my customer. So, you know, I put an obsessive amount of detail into the clothes, and just to ensure that that happens, like there's stretch in most things, and there's, you know, like when you turn things inside out, it's almost as nice on the inside as it is on the outside.
And quality, yeah.
It's all that. Well, it's not even, yes, of course, quality, but then also there's a lot of stuff going on the inside that really does facilitate that experience mm-hmm. for her. Like when she puts it on and does that final mirror check and confirms how gorgeous she is, she doesn't need to be thinking about that anymore. You know what I mean? Because I know mm-hmm. I saw that. Things are not riding up. Things are not
yeah.
falling down. Things are not doing this. And that, you know, oftentimes takes a lot of engineering to make things just hang properly on your body as you go through your life, you know? And
that's true.
So that's it. It's like it's really a lot of focus on that, on her and on her experience. Mm-hmm. And, yeah, and I'm really, really having a good time with it. This is going to
wow,
be our first cool. season shipping, spring uh-huh. 2021. So that's coming up very soon, like our first deliveries in March.
Moving on to another question for you. We're almost done here.
Mm-hmm.
What advice can you give a young designer coming up today?
You know, the strongest advice that I can give a young designer coming up today, because there's so many aspects of this business that has changed that probably don't even leave me at liberty to give a lot of really technical advice about how they should approach entering this now with all the many challenges we broached just before getting here.
Mm-hmm.
But the one thing that I think is absolutely non-negotiable to make a difference is to really be true to your authentic, creative self. That is the only thing that will ever distinguish your product from the next guy's product or the next girl's product or the next, you know.
Mm-hmm.
And you really cannot be obsessed with other people's likes and other people's anything. You got to find your own path, your own customer, and be true to her or him if you do menswear.
Right. Okay. And okay, so you've pitched your new line. We're
mm-hmm.
looking forward for that. You've given the advice to young designers. You gave me your hurdles. I know you've worked with a lot of celebrities. What was the high? What was one of the biggest highs in your career?
Absolutely, Michelle Obama. You know, like, because, come on. It's Michelle Obama. You know,
uh-huh.
I just, that whole family, you know, if you could ever, like, just give a bear hug to a family, it's that one. I just imagine picking them all up and their feet uh-huh. dangling, and I've got them all in my arms, like, squeezing them, and their eyes are bulging a little. So... yeah, it would definitely be her for just, you know,
okay,
all the reasons that we all adore her. Uh-huh. And not the least of which being that, like, you know, she had the smarts to show us all that she wore things multiple times, like we do.
Mm-hmm.
You know, there's one dress of mine that she wore four times. Four times being photographed. It's like, no, I'm not wearing this and hiding it in the basement because, like, you know, this is like popcorn night at the White House. You know?
You're really funny.
No. I mean, but you know what I'm saying, Al.
Yeah, no, I do.
Like, you wore it here for your big moment, but now nobody saw you wear it there, so you're going to just, like, you know. Where you can't hear on the down low. I just love the fact that she just does that and did that. I just adore her for so many reasons. And that was, I think, probably one of my biggest celebrity moments. But usually, like, when they ask that question, you know, it's just like, I don't really put a celebrity moment ahead of my average customer because it really does come back to, again, that experience that she's having. And, you know, it just so happens that their jobs are, you know, public luminaries, and other people's jobs, like, look, I need to put this sheath dress on and crush this meeting right quick. And I know I can do that because mama's looking good. You know what I mean? So
yeah.
It really is pretty much the same charge when they're in the public eye or when they're not. You know, when at least when I'm a part of the story and I actually know what's happening, you know. Because the thing about celebrities, you know, working with them and coming in, it's like when you actually hear their stories, and whenever they came to the studio, they just get very, very honest. I'm like, oh, my gosh, we are just all out here in these streets trying to make it happen. It's like every time I try and live vicariously through somebody else, I'm like, oh, no, I'm sure it's easy for you, which I've given up on now. It just doesn't exist. Everybody's, like, just working hard. Like I said, that Calvin Klein moment, they just kept coming. In every other industry, I'm like, okay, well, then I know they really have it easy and great. And it's just like, listen, it is great. Because here's the thing that's great. The blessing is in the work. And part of it, you got to just enjoy the journey.
I'm Kayleen Peoples, and this is Talk Agenda. This episode is sponsored by Bella Composers. And you're listening to Amy Marie by People's Republic. This is off of a new Rite of Passage CD.
Swan Spelling. Mirobe. Vivre en Dieu.